and we're talking today about the Albuquerque Cultural Conference. Later in the program, we'll be talking to Luis Rodriguez. Right now, I would like to welcome John Crawford. He is founder and director of the Albuquerque Cultural Conference. He's publisher of West End Press and professor emeritus of English at UNM. Now, what is this conference about?
It's interesting. Actually, the conference had its origins in something called the Midwest Cultural Conference in Kansas City. And about, I think it was 1978. I was then the publisher of this small press, West End Press. We were publishing a lot of people from the upper Midwest, including Maribel LeSueur. And at this conference, we invited a number of the older authors going back to the 30s, most of them progressive or radical in some form, but they were also people that were really instrumental to a whole couple of decades of writing in the U.S. And these original conferences were kind of an homage to those writers. Later on, I left Kansas City and relocated in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where I've been here now about 23 years. And we started up again with these conferences about 5 years ago. And now they're intended to draw all kinds of people and performers in. Albuquerque is a place where there was a vigorous slam poetry scene. A lot of those slam poets matured into, or at least changed into, performance poets. Then we started drawing people in just because of the strength of the local writers. And I've been very happy with this. It's a bunch of people that I found a lot in common with. And we've still tried to bring in people from outside to be involved in the conference. Some of the issues that we take up are really national issues as well as regional.
What are some of the issues that you're working with?
It would be, for instance, escalating pressures on our communities, cultural pressures, and our schools, and our freedom of expression. Things like community development programs that actually may destroy some of the community values that already exist. attacks on education that are disguised as attempts to improve school curricula. There's a lot of that going on right now. And attacks on the funding of artistic expression. We're concerned about the future of the National Endowment for the Arts and you know, humanities. But we're looking at it as cultural people who are artists and writers who are primarily on the progressive side and are wanting to continue to enjoy access to the broadest audience possible.
It's interesting, you used the word radical before, and I am often reminded that the etymology of the word radical is root, and that the roots of our country are fundamentally revolutionary and are about equality and democracy and things like that.
Yeah. Certainly the first part, we're really trying to work with people who are not connected with large institutions that pretty much tell them what to do. We're much more interested in you might say normal people, and in the concerns of whole communities about where we're headed and what we're doing and what our cultural expression looks like. So it is rooted in that sense. By radical, I also meant people like Maribel LeSueur, who was a real fighter for women's rights. Her mom had been a suffragist working for the woman's vote in the 19-teens, and her family went back several generations. They were Midwestern populists. We started with her because she was so wonderfully outspoken. From there, I went to poets who sometimes were out of the mainstream because of their writing. Thomas McGrath was another one from the Midwest. He was a left-wing poet and would have been a lot more famous if he had been anything but what he was politically. I was very involved in publishing multicultural writers, especially women, in the 70s and 80s. And I was very privileged to be able to find people. You know, the corporate media just didn't sweep those people up and start befriending them. They really had to find supporters wherever they could. And my little press and the conferences that we held were part of that. It was a much broader thing than just us. One of the people attending the conference is Lorna de Cervantes, who I've known her for about 25 years. She's a wonderful Chicana poet from California, really courageous and brave and funny and just a great person. I think she's always been a little bit much with the establishment, but she's a great friend of ours, and we're really happy to have her here.
Let's talk for a moment about what happened in the Tucson public schools with regard to Mexican-American studies, which is part of the whole set of issues that you're working with at the Albuquerque Cultural Conference. What happened?
Well, for about 3 years, we've been in touch with people down in Tucson. There are some wonderful educators there. There's a great deal of political conflict in Arizona, which I think most people identify with the issues around the border. There were two pieces of legislation passed in Arizona. One about, it's a sort of a stop anyone on suspicion of being, an illegal alien, to use that terminology. And the other thing is that the school system in Arizona, it's a fairly right-wing government, and the school system is very leery of teaching cultural studies that have anything to do with other nationalities besides the Anglo-American population in the United States. And they were coming down pretty hard for years on the, especially the Mexican-American population. And attempts to teach in the high schools classes on Mexican-American culture and heritage always ran into trouble. And in the last year or two, it's gotten worse. And basically what they've done now is to cancel only courses in Mexican-American studies. They've left everything else pretty much the same. But their idea is that it's somehow kind of a plot against the Anglo-American population to stir people up with courses in their own background and heritage. That's where the issues began. And they've used an awful lot of people in charge of this state education have become state politicians, stuff like that. There's been a real kind of an inner circle of people that have tried to silence the whole field of Mexican-American studies, especially in Tucson. Tucson being the border city that is of some size and a real center of intellectual activity. There's a lot going on in Tucson, but these folks don't like it very much. It comes from the governor right on down, so we're dealing with pretty much the establishment.
There is a list of banned books that is almost hilarious, and that includes Shakespeare, and it includes Sandra Cisneros, and it includes people who are just utterly mainstream major cultural figures. And I've read a bunch of those books and gotten a lot out of them, as have people of many backgrounds. These classes in Tucson, these Mexican-American studies classes, were they being attended by all different students? Were they being attended by white students?
They were open to all students. I think the majority was probably Mexican-American. And the majority of those would be legal. I mean, their families might have been here generations. As far as the books are concerned, you're right. There were some that were very odd to find on any such list. Shakespeare's play, The Tempest, I think because it's about someone who is held to be native and captive. They didn't want that one getting out. But also people like Paulo Freire, who's a great educator, and he wrote a book called Pedagogy of the Oppressed, which has to do with teaching methods among poor people and how you basically teach literacy. And for them to attack that book in the way they did suggested a lot, I think, to some of us about they really didn't want an equal playing field. If you can't even read books about how to teach, I don't know where you're going, but there are also many other books.
There were people who were saying, when confronted with this question about the book, The Pedagogy of the Oppressed, it's, we don't want to teach anybody that they're oppressed. even if they are. I mean, it's like a kind of denial that there is such thing as oppression in the United States, there is such thing as racism.
Yeah. And the denial, I think, is more prevalent among white people than it is anywhere else, because if you're being oppressed, you probably know it. It's not news. But it was offensive to the sensibilities of the dominant population. I don't mean it all the white people. I mean, that would be silly. But the ones who were in charge didn't like that consciousness of oppression to be taught in the schools.
Now, when somebody tries to ban books, or when somebody tries to basically direct learning away from what teachers want to teach and what students want to learn to what politicians want them to teach and learn, there's usually a sense that something about their dominance is being threatened. What is, do you think, is being threatened that causes them to take actions of actual censorship and control of this curriculum?
What they kept saying was that the American way of life was being threatened. I think essentially it's the whole narrative of America being the place of independence and freedom, because the conditions in southern Arizona don't look very independent and free for the Mexican Americans. And they kept going back to the glories of the American system of government. And I think what worried them more than anything else was exposure, that this just wasn't the way things were being done. And that was enough right there. The other thing was, I mean, there was some outright racism. There was concern that the people coming across the border were going to be taking over the state. It was the confusion between Mexican Americans and recent immigrants without papers was just rampant. I don't think the people in power distinguish between the two even. But it's an ugly situation, and it keeps the sides are pretty well drawn. And you could say racism is behind all of it, but I think that's exaggerating. I think it's more than that. It's a sense that this government is fragile because it hides a few things that if people really address them, they'd have to deal with them somehow.
And what are those things?
Equal rights, to begin with. I mean, this is looking like a civil rights situation, as in the South earlier, the right to equal education, the whole question of an unevenness in wealth. Some people said this is a class issue more than anything else. But in a world, in the American society right now, where it's already going through economic stresses, it's also worse if you are a poor person of Mexican descent. And they know that, and they really don't want to have that button pressed. I think they're highly defensive culturally and economically.
Now, the whole country, when Tucson banned the Mexican-American Studies curriculum and, I mean, snatched books out of the hands of students who were using them and made them cry and told teachers to stop teaching. I mean, it was really cinematic in its drama. The whole country took note, and indeed the whole world took note and responded to these attacks. What were some of the responses in Tucson and from the outside?
One of the teachers who's coming to the conference is a wonderful guy. He's Roberto Rodriguez. He is now he's an assistant professor at the University of Arizona, in Tucson. Roberto was one of a group of people that was conducting this battle mostly around the high schools. But what you begin to get is a group of concerned teachers and professors, and also people who are simply basically believe in democracy. When that kind of fear begins to spread that there's some other bunch who are trying to gain more power and influence, you know, it almost becomes a kind of paranoia. And I think a lot of what they've been running into in that part of the country is that. Also, there is a history attached to this, the Gadsden Purchase. in the 1850s, where the United States conquered territory in northern Mexico and then arranged for it to be transferred over to the United States control. Part of this territory, including Tucson, was Mexican. And in a sense, I think the fear that people will remember that is much greater on the part of the white politicians.
There was a quotation in an essay that you wrote, and it said something like, we didn't discover America, America discovered us.
Yes, yes, that's right. That's actually by a Chicano playwright. He's well known, but I can't remember his name. But he was coming out of the 1950s and 1960s, and he was expressing his irritation about, you know, the fact that it was like you always hear about, you know, America discovering, about the United States discovering these people. And after all, they've had a separate identity and life for 1,000 years before that. There's quite a bit of solidarity now in southern Arizona among Native American people and Mexican American people. Because one of the things that happens is the Border Patrol stops you if you look suspicious. And a lot of the Indian people in that area, the Tohono O'odham, the tribe, they used to be called the Yaquis, they get stopped all the time on suspicion of being an illegal immigrant. And, you know, it becomes kind of a running joke that they were here first.
Right.
But no, there is a lot of that, and I think the intensity of that concern is more with the white folks that are running the show than it is actually with the indigenous people. But they're beginning to remember that and think about it and think, well, why don't we at least have fundamental rights? You know, what's going on?
So has there been? I mean, there were sit-ins and teach-ins and protests, and every major literary and publishing organization in the country and the United Nations, everybody protested Arizona's banning of the Tucson curriculum. And what's happened? Has there been any sign of change in the powers that be?
There's litigation going on all over the place, and it's serious, and it may eventually have some effect. The Supreme Court, in a matter having to do with the immigration situation, came up with a ruling about a month and a half ago where they split the difference. Some kinds of things they ruled out as oppressive that the police were doing, and other things they left in. So it's going to be a battle on the educational front, too, that I think probably is going to go to the highest courts. But that takes time. And frankly, all the money's on the other side. You know, even your ability to get attorneys who are very good and who are willing to stick with something like this for years is a major issue that they're confronting. And the school board in Tucson, which would be a major player in this, didn't voluntarily do all these things. It was pushed by people in the state who were going to withdraw funding from the school system. So you are fighting a very lopsided battle still. One thing about Roberto Rodriguez and some of his friends, the high school teacher who was the main developer of the original program that got banned was fired. He was simply fired by the school board. So not only was the program stopped, but so was the chief organizer of the program. At the college level, at the university, where there was a lot of, it was like a think tank. There were a lot of people working on this. Rodriguez has been threatened physically. He's also in the middle of a lawsuit because he called somebody a bad name and they said he slandered him. I mean, the people with money have the ability to sue over things like that. But I know the situation there is tense, and it's very one-sided.
So after that, were any teachers, I mean, there are a lot of teachers spoke out and they weren't supposed to. Were any of them fired or punished for speaking out and for defending students who wanted to keep studying their curriculum?
This isn't the beginning of issues like that. There had been problems all over the Southwest at one time or another that are at least suspicious. But a sure situation where you're going to be stressed is in seeking promotion and tenure. And those things can be buried under academic language. The famous one was Ward Churchill in Colorado about 4 or 5 years ago.
Right.
But there are, yes, now there are people in Arizona whose jobs, I'm sure, are at risk, both in the high schools and in the university.
Has this whole issue organized people? I mean, you talked about what I'm sure was an unintended consequence of the Arizona law, which is building solidarity between Mexican and Mexican-American and Native American people. Has this whole attack on education helped to organize people and get them fighting more strongly for their rights?
I think it is now. It took a little while to build up a head of steam, but after all, there was a very large Chicano movement which started a decade or so ago, and in a way, this has given it more impetus. It's also more theoretically sophisticated than it once was, and a lot of work is going into scholarship again, which was not there so much. There are a lot of other people involved in this. There are a lot of Anglo-Americans who are upset about this, and certainly on the area of the defense of civil liberties. So, yeah, I'd say it's gaining. It took about 6 months for this to really roll, but I think you'll see more and more of that. It's a little bit like the South historically. I wouldn't be surprised to see a burgeoning civil rights movement in the Southwest.
Very interesting. John Crawford is founder and director of the Albuquerque Cultural Conference. That is on the web at albuquerqueculturalconference.org. He's publisher of West End Press, professor emeritus of English at the University of New Mexico. And will you be speaking at the conference?
Yes, I will. And I wanted to mention one other person, at least, who's coming from the University of Arizona, Sandra Soto, who's a chair of feminist studies at the University of Arizona, and incredibly well-regarded by people around the country. I mean, these are not just discontented folks. These are people whose whole sense of their career involves doing it right, and we're proud of that. And we have good people in New Mexico who are kind of waiting to greet them, too.
Well, we look forward to it, and we want to thank you for being on the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you very much.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Luis Rodriguez. He is a poet, writer, and activist, and he will be at the Albuquerque Cultural Conference this coming weekend. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
So in your memoir, which I've just been reading, called It Calls You Back, you describe this whole process of getting out of drugs and gang-focused life and moving toward peacemaking among gangs and working against police violence and working for your community. And you and your friends who were doing this work were continually spied on and detained and beaten up by the authorities, and they seemed to be very much against your peacemaking efforts. Why? Explain that time.
Well, you know, it was a time in which there was so much activity and there was a lot of fear, and we were, as you know, as a country emerging out of that conservative 50s and early 60s period, the 60s scared the heck out of people. You know what I'm saying? And unfortunately, some people to this day have been at war with the 60s. And one of the ways they thought it could work is if they repressed whatever motion, activity, whether it was good or bad, didn't seem to matter. Anything related to people getting organized, standing up, you know, having a voice, and that's what I think was behind a lot of this. We could have had peace in the streets a long time ago, but that would mean that people would have to have meaningful, political, strong, spiritually engaged lives. And for some reason, that wasn't happening.
And what happened then? Was there eventually any progress in terms of relationships with the police, or not so much?
Well, no, I think there has been progress, and that's kind of hard to imagine. Since I've been doing this for 40 years, I have seen some changes in, for example, the LAPD and the LA City that I have not seen in those 40 years. There's more openness to gang intervention, for example, more openness to prevention programs. It doesn't mean it's perfect. There's still a lot of corruption as far as the sheriffs and the LAPD goes. There's still people being put away that shouldn't be put away. The laws are still crazy with, you know, 20, 30, 40 years given to kids lost life sentences. So we have a long way to go, but I do think that something changed. In many ways, people seem to be more open to the things that we were trying to do 40 years ago that was smashed.
At the same time, the inequality and the economic segregation is still with us, perhaps as strong as ever. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think the big source of all the problems as far as gangs go, as far as violence, even drugs, is poverty. And so the efforts to do that have not really fared very well. I'm not saying it's totally bad. People did a number of things, but I heard a statistic where the percentage of poor is now gone or is reaching the level as it was in the 60s before the war on poverty started. So the economy, the financial institutions, everything's in crisis. And this is where we're at right now as a country. What are we going to do? Where are we going to go? Obviously, you cannot repress or arrest our way out of this problem. We have to do something fundamental about the economic roots, why things are where they are.
Now, you were part of a delegation sent to El Salvador this past summer to look at the gang peace truce that happened there. El Salvador has major problems with street gangs, which are related to United States and immigration policy and things like that. Talk about El Salvador and the United States and what those links are.
Well, one is that most of the kids that joined gangs were refugees to L.A. during the Civil War. 75 people died in 12 years. But unfortunately, those refugee kids grew up in L.A., you know, barrio ghettos, and some of them got involved in the body warfare that had already been there, influenced by the Chicano and African-American gangs that had been there already. As you know, L.A. was a gang cap of the world. There's Bloods and Crips. There's all these Sureño gangs. There's all these older Chicano gangs. The Salvadorians, like Guatemalans, like Hondurans, got influenced by it. They started their gangs. They got into the other ones. And unfortunately, U.S. started deporting them after the L.A. riot. It was one way for them to so-called resolve the gang problem because they felt that the gangs were behind the riots. Unfortunately, what they did is export the L.A. gang culture to countries that never had it before, like El Salvador, Guatemala, Mexico, parts of Mexico, Honduras. And unfortunately, they brought all what they learned in the California prison systems with the older Chicano gangs back to those countries. So for 20 years, this started in 92, we've had the terrible violence in El Salvador. It became the world number one homicide country in the world. This year, many of the older gang members have been calling for peace. I went down there as part of a delegation to support that effort, to at least access it, you know, assist it, advise it, whatever we could do. I found that the gang members were very sincere. I think they really do want peace. But what we're really concerned is that there could come to the table some meaningful jobs, real education, decent health care, treatment for drug and mental illness, prison reform. In other words, the peace is holding 70% drop in violence since March. But now the rest of the country, the rest of the world has to come in and say, we'll do our end. I'm hoping that that's the direction things are going to go.
It's so tragic to me as an observer and as an American that first in the 80s we exported from the School of the Americas methods of torture and killing and things like that, and then in later we exported gang culture.
Exactly, and I think this is something that we have to take responsibility for. We can't take responsibility for everything that happens in El Salvador, but, you know, we don't do this. We don't reconcile to what was done. We supported that civil war, and it caused so much destruction. And then we're pissed off that all these immigrants came as refugees. And then when we think there's a problem here, we're going to export the kids that came into the gang world because of discrimination and poverty in this country. You understand? They didn't have that in El Salvador. They never had these kind of gangs, these tattooed, you know, heavily, baggy pants dressed, you know, kids. This is a U.S. phenomenon that we exported. And I think that this is why I would love to see our country support the peace. That's something we kind of owe the people of El Salvador. We owe them to say, okay, we did wrong. Now we need to help. Because now these young people are tired of the war. Now, if there's no jobs and poverty continues, I would surmise that the violence is going to come back because people are trying to survive with nothing. I hope that this opportunity, this window of opportunity, we really do something decent there.
To support peace, whether it be in L.A. gangs or whether it be in El Salvador, my sense is that you really have to actually truly support things that you were saying before, which is not only economic self-sufficiency, but economic autonomy. In other words, those countries are not colonies whose resources are ours to be exploited, but they really belong to those people.
Right, and I think that's exactly right. You know, it's putting it back in the hands of the Salvadorian people. There's nothing that we can do on the outside, but what we can do, because billions of dollars has been sent to El Salvador, but it was mainly to repress the gangs, build more prisons, build up a police force. It didn't do anything for the jobs and poverty. I just think it's just a matter then maybe we can put some resources that would actually help the country, put it in the hands of the communities. This gang peace shouldn't just help gang members, it should help the whole country. So I'm hoping that that's the direction that we can convince people to take, you know, take part in this.
And pretty much the same thing in United States gangs, I would think.
Yeah, you know, and that's really the lesson. I've been for 40 years, I've been working with gang peace efforts. It was Bloods and Crips. It was the Chicano gangs in the 70s. It was Chicago gangs. I've been around the country talking to gang kids, and we don't do enough for our own kids. I don't think most kids would be in gangs if we could address issues of the poverty and the unemployment and the educational. It seems to me that we keep working on the back end of it, which is more prisons, more prisons, more prisons. And the front end is really the answer. Can we provide resources, jobs, training, treatment? And it's so much less costlier. People don't realize the billions of dollars is being wasted just to put kids away when we could be doing better as far as the front end. So, yeah, I'm really concerned that we begin to pay attention to that in this country.
Not to mention the amount of gang activity that goes on and is cultivated in prisons.
Yeah, and see, the problem is that people thought, well, we put these kids in prison, we hide them out, you know, in California, I'm sure, in New Mexico and other states, they have these high-end, you know, secured housing units. And then it turned out that they actually got more organized, more cohesive, and began to organize even more things in the streets. It doesn't work to repress the violence. It just doesn't work, and yet we're not getting the answers. Like in California, we have a 70% recidivism rate. That means that 7% of people coming out of these prisons end up going back. That's a failure rate. Any industry, any business would die, would be cut off if it had that kind of rate. But yet we continue to feed that monster. And I think the answer is rehabilitation, something redeeming, restorative justice, all these things that we have within our purview to do. That's where we have to go.
We're talking to Luis Rodriguez. You had such an interesting and rough life, but you kept on surviving. You were in this kind of gang culture, and then somehow you got out of gangs and got out of drugs, and you got married and had a family, and then you were doing carpentry, and you were a steel worker, and you describe in some detail how those trades had opened up to people of color, but they still weren't treating you well, and you were politically active then. And then you moved toward journalism and writing and publishing. How did that transition happen?
Well, I think what's important about that is that somebody has to find a meaningful life. I was so self-destructive and destructive of others. When I got involved with the civil rights struggle, politics, the Chicano movement, it really gave me purpose and meaning, where I could put whatever I had as far as skills, talents, and interests into keeping that movement going. And that kind of pushed me through everything, working and then realizing that working was not going to do it. I was working in the industry and steel mills and all that work. I really had this dream, and I had to meet that dream, and that was the writing dream, to be a writer. I loved books. Even in the streets, I was like a weird homie with books. You know, even when I was using heroin, I loved to read, and that kept me going, and I decided to move in that direction. It wasn't easy, as you can tell from the book, but it was important that everybody try to meet their dream. They're born with a dream, and their whole life has to be how they put their resources and everything behind it. Because you know how many people live this world, and sometimes maybe they're doing okay, they look like they're doing okay, and they're not living their life. You know what I'm saying? They're not really living what they were born to do, and I felt that's what I had to do, even if it went against anybody else's idea.
And I think it's so important to hold in mind that every single person is born with some talent, and you describe that in your book. Every young person has something that they're just wonderful at, and if that doesn't get crushed, they can really have a future.
Absolutely. I think that that's what's important. It's kind of like having a whole new paradigm about how we look at our communities, our youth, even when they get in trouble. That shouldn't be seen as the worst thing that could happen. Many ways you express what you're about through trouble. I think we just have to be prepared to really look at the genius of young people. Every one of them has their own genius, their own thread, their own capacity that we just have to look at, pay attention to, and hopefully bring out. Because that, to me, is the key to dealing with violence, dealing with the kind of suicidal, destructive rage that a lot of young people and other people are involved with. I think the answer is right there. Believe and trust that young people have the capacity to do amazing things.
Now, you got a job writing for a newspaper, and let's talk for a moment about the phenomenon of newspaper reporters. There's been a movement toward getting more diversity in newspapers, reporters, in other words, having it not just be white males, but this is also suffering in the decline of the daily printed newspaper. How do you see this whole world and this whole set of questions?
Well, you know, it was evident to me that especially when I got into newspapers in 1980, we were not being heard. I'm talking about people of color, women, other communities that just didn't have any representation in the news. And even though reporters and journalists are supposed to be objective, they were mostly white, middle class, and for the most part, you know, Republican, conservative. That's the world that I had to help break down. I know I did it. I also ended up quitting that whole world. But it was worth it to try to bring in some voices and stories. It was very hard, just like I went through when I worked in industry. We were trying to get into the skilled trades, just like trying to break through all those glass ceilings, all those doors that were closed in on us. People from the last 40 years have been struggling. People say people have given us things. We haven't been gotten nothing for nothing. We fought hard every step of the way, organized, and we tore down a lot of walls. We still have more to go, as you know. And so my feeling is that, yeah, things are changing. Technology is changing. Now we got to think about how we can be integrated in the new technology and not be lost as we were in the past when people were blocking us.
Do you see any positive movement in that direction?
You know, I think I find one of the good things about like the internet is almost everybody has a place in it. In just a matter of how you present what you present, how it resonates with people. I'm surprised the things that go viral, you know what I mean? Most of it's silly, but some of it is interesting. People want new ideas. They want imagination. So I think this is an openness that is not dependent on a big corporate, you know, publishing world or a big corporate newspaper or whatever to say, we're going to hire you, you're going to pay your dues. This is open to people who just have the discipline to put forward ideas in the most interesting way. I think there's great possibilities in it if people really take advantage of it.
Now, tell us about Tia Chucha's Centro Cultural and Press. How did that come into being?
You know, it came out of just the same thing, being blocked out. I couldn't get my books published. I was trying to do poetry. I decided to do it myself, and eventually that opened doors with other publishers. The same thing with Tia Chucha's. That was Tia Chucha Press, and now we've published like 60 books by others. I don't publish myself anymore, and we have cross-cultural selection of poets from around the country now. Tia Chucha's Centro Cultural, which is related, is a full arts performance space, open mic space. We just decided, me and my wife, to create a space that would be run by the arts, for the arts, and for the community. And now we have, like, I think we serve close to 8,000 people a year, just on the 8,000 to 12,000 people a year, just giving them arts training, and almost all of it for free. I'm talking about from writing to dance to theater to painting to music, all kinds of music. That's what I felt was important because I know art saved me when I was a kid, and I feel like I got to give back in that same direction.
One of the things I see among young people, I think because the mass media have become somehow more integrated, certainly a lot more than when I was a kid, I see little white kids doing breakdancing and people hanging out with each other without regard to color and the kind of prejudices that we grew up with. And I wonder, what do you see among the young generation? Are they truly integrating?
My sons tell me that. I have 24 and 18-year-old kids. They tell me that race is not the biggest problem as when I was growing up. And I'm kind of glad. I don't think it should be. I still think there's issues of race, as you know. Even Obama gets weird attacks that echo to another time. But for the most part, I think people are starting to break from that hold. I think what they're looking at more, which I think is probably much more important, is class. Who's got the money? Who's getting corporate support? Who doesn't? The gap between the poorest and the wealthiest is getting bigger and bigger, as you know. And among the poor is not just people of color, even though we might have a big percentage of it, the vast majority are white people. So I think this is where interest starts shifting. Isn't it probably in the interest of poor white people to come together with people of color who are also poor, then to unite along racial lines to rich people who don't care a hoot about them? I think things are shifting about what is really important and who's our enemies and who are not. And I don't mean enemies that we should attack them or hurt them. I'm talking about people whose interests don't jive with ours. I'm all for the best, most peaceful, imaginative way to handle that. But I do think that interests are shifting and people hopefully are moving away from, I'm only in this or with these people because they're the same color as me.
Now, you were involved in the Justice Party, and you were, in fact, running as vice president. Tell us about that whole movement.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. This is an important electoral time, as you know. But we still have run by two parties that are pretty much the same. I mean, yeah, there's differences between them, but not much. Neither one of those parties, I'm convinced, are going to resolve the crisis we have in our economy, on the financial institutions, in politics. We have, despite the fact that we are the most free country in the world, we have a very closed democratic process. What I mean by that is that if you really want to have a voice, you have to have a lot of money. Money dictates who's going to run. The two-party systems are both financed by corporations, big money, some of the same people. And so I think that the Justice Party is trying to say we need to open up this process to other voices, other interests, other concerns, to make it what our democratic places should be, one man, one vote, and everybody who has an ability to run to have the same amount of time as everybody else. This is something that we expect of others. The U.S. goes around the world saying this is what democracy is and even offers them the plan, and it's very beautiful, but we don't do it in our own country. So I think that's what the Justice Party is trying to do, open up this process.
What is their platform?
Well, it's economic justice in poverty, environmental justice to have a clean and green world. We don't need to live in the kind of world that's so polluted and toxic, the one we're in now. Political justice, open up the process. Don't make it a corporate-run political process. In other words, justice in every area of our culture and our economic and political life.
So you will be at the Albuquerque Cultural Conference this weekend. What will you be doing there?
Well, I'm going to be doing a reading Thursday night with my friend Richard Garcia. We're going to have Dos Hombres, Two Men, an evening of poetry. That'll be at 7 p.m. at the Dean Smith Hall, 125 Lecture Room. On Friday evening, I will be part of a great number of poets at and this will be the opening of the Albuquerque Cultural Conference. That's the Outpost Performance Space. And in Albuquerque, we're going to have a number of poets. Lorna D. Cervantes, David Martinez, Margaret Randall, Eva Romero, Richard Vargas, anyway, Susan Sherman, a number of people. And then the next day, I will be on a panel as part of the conference at 11 o'clock on the borders and the culture and influence of the border. So I'm really excited about this. I think it's going to be great. I hope a lot of people show up, especially my many friends and fans that I have in Albuquerque.
The website is albuquerquecultureconference.org. Luis Rodriguez is a poet, writer, and activist. He can be found at luisjrodriguez.com. And I've just been reading your wonderful memoir, It Calls You Back. Highly recommended. And thank you very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, dude. Anytime. Thank you.